Usually when we talk about civilized society, there's this really comforting expectation of
Oh,
permanence.
for sure. It feels structural.
Yeah, it feels like concrete. Like you walk down a paved street, you see a police officer on the corner, maybe a butcher shop open for business, and you just think, well, this is reality. This is just how human beings naturally operate.
Right. We assume those guardrails are just, a permanent part of the human condition because we rely on them every single day to dictate our boundaries.
But then you step into the world of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, and suddenly that concrete starts feeling like very, very thin ice.
It really does. It's terrifying, honestly.
Is. We are looking at a psychological landscape where those external rules, the policeman and the butcher, as the book literally puts it, are entirely stripped away. And today, we are bringing you a Clara and Horatio Book Candy Companion conversation to explore precisely what happens when that ice breaks.
And this is designed for you, the listener, as a literate, engaging roadmap before or even after you experience the Clara and Horatio audiobook of Conrad's masterpiece.
Yeah, and just to set the parameters right away, this is a full companion conversation. We're
Yeah.
exploring the entire journey, so complete spoilers for the text are baked into the discussion from here on out.
Which is necessary, really. It's a journey that demands full exploration. I mean, we're looking at a story published in 1899, written by a man who actually lived through much of what he's describing.
Right, Joseph Conrad was actually a mariner.
Yeah, he was a man who commanded a river steamboat during the height of European imperial expansion in Africa. So the book is this incredibly dense, layered text. On the surface, it masquerades as a Victorian adventure tale, but underneath, it is a profound, unsparing exploration of the fragility of human restraint.
The stakes here are just incredibly high. Like we're following a man named Marlowe as he navigates this mighty snake-like river into the absolute unknown, only to find that the true terror isn't, the jungle.
Right, or the native populations, or the diseases.
Yeah, the true terror is the boundless capacity for brutality within the human mind itself. It makes me think of like a psychological survival situation. You're dropped into the wilderness and you expect the monster to be lurking in the woods.
But the monster is actually your own unchecked potential.
Yes. Does the removal of societal rules create a monster, or does it simply unmask one that was always there?
That is the pivotal question of the entire text. Are we inherently moral creatures who occasionally stumble, or are we inherently savage creatures just being held in check by the artificial pressure of civilization?
And Conrad does not offer comforting answers.
No, he really doesn't. To understand this descent into the self, we first have to look at where the story begins and the remarkable historical mirroring the author uses to set the stage. Because the story doesn't actually begin in the jungle.
Right, it begins in England. It starts on a boat called the Nelly, which is a cruising yawl anchored on the River Thames at dusk.
Yeah.
So we have this frame narrative. A group of men are sitting together, the director of companies, the lawyer, the accountant, and our narrator, Marlowe.
And Marlowe is sitting cross-legged right aft, leaning against the mast, and the text says he resembles an ascetic idol.
The setting here is so crucial. They're floating on the Thames, right in the heart of the British Empire, the very center of what they consider the pinnacle of the civilized world.
And the unnamed narrator, who is listening to Marlowe, describes the Thames in these glowing, almost mythical terms. He evokes the great knights errant of the sea guys, like Francis Drake, Sir John Franklin.
Men who went out bearing the sword and the torch.
Yeah, messengers of the might within the land. He talks about the dreams of men, the seat of commonwealths, the germs of empires floating out on that river.
It sounds so noble, so
Yeah.
grandiose, but then as the sun sets and the physical world around these men literally plunges into pitch darkness, the temperature just completely changes. Marlowe suddenly speaks up out of nowhere.
Right. He looks out at the brooding gloom over London and says, "And this also has been one of the dark places of the earth."
It is such a brilliant, destabilizing opening. By having Marlowe equate the civilized British Empire of the 19th century to the ancient, savage Britain conquered by the Romans 1900 years ago, the book immediately undercuts the idea of permanent, inherent civilization.
Marlowe asks his listeners to imagine a Roman commander coming to the very end of the world. Imagine a sea the color of lead, a sky the color of smoke, sandbanks, marshes, forests, savages, disease, exile, and death just, skulking in the air.
He paints this picture of a civilized Roman citizen landing in a swamp, marching through the woods, and feeling the utter savagery closing around him. The fascination of the abomination, as Marlowe calls it.
Yeah, the growing regrets, the longing to escape, the powerless disgust, the surrender, the hate.
And what strikes me is how he forces these very comfortable Victorian men on the Nelly to realize that their pristine, paved city was, historically speaking, a terrifying jungle just 5 minutes ago.
It's a direct mirror to what Marlowe himself is about to experience and what the European powers are doing in the setting of the story. The cultural setting of Marlowe's main tale involves what he calls a continental concern, a massive trading society aiming to run an overseas empire for profit.
We're mapping the world in colors.
Yeah. Red for British territories, blue, green, orange, and then this yellow patch dead in the center of the continent. That yellow patch is where Marlowe is going.
And he notes that the administration of these conquerors is merely a squeeze. They are grabbers. He calls it robbery with violence, aggravated murder on a great scale.
But then he says something that genuinely makes you pause and struggle with his worldview. He claims that the conquest of the earth is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much, but what redeems it is the idea only.
An unselfish belief in the idea.
Right. Something you can set up and bow down before and offer a sacrifice to.
How do we even reconcile that? Is the book suggesting that having a noble civilizing mission actually justifies the brutality? Or is Marlowe exposing the idea itself as a dangerous, self-deluding myth? Because saying an idea redeems mass robbery feels incredibly contradictory.
It does. And if we connect this to the broader mechanics of the text, I would argue strongly for the latter. The idea is the overarching myth that allows civilized people to sleep at night while atrocities are committed in their name.
Throughout the text, we hear about the International Society for the Suppression of Savage Customs and the lofty rhetoric of humanizing, improving, instructing.
But what Marlowe actually encounters is the complete opposite of that rhetoric. The idea is merely a cloak for the rapacious greed beneath it. Marlowe is acknowledging the function of the idea, how it operates psychologically to shield the conquerors from their own reflection.
But his journey just systematically destroys any validity that idea might hold.
Yeah, it completely shreds it. And Marlowe warns us right at the start about how to process his story. The unnamed narrator on the Nelly tells us that for most seamen, the meaning of a yarn is like the kernel inside a cracked nut. You crack it open, there's the obvious moral, you eat it, you move on.
Right. But Marlowe is different. To him, the meaning of an episode is not inside like a kernel, but outside. Enveloping the tale, which brought it out only as a glow, brings out a haze, in the likeness of one of these misty halos that sometimes are made visible by the spectral illumination of moonshine.
Which is such a gorgeous way of putting it, and that is a critical instruction for you, the listener. It signals that the plot itself, the literal sequence of physical events, is just a vehicle.
The real meaning of Heart of Darkness is in the atmosphere, the psychological dread, the emotional resonance of the journey. It is not about what happens next in a purely mechanical sense. It is about how what happens degrades the human soul.
Spot on. But to understand that haze, we do need to trace the physical journey. Let's map out Marlowe's descent into that yellow center of the map, and let's try to understand the psychology behind each of these stops.
Marlowe begins in Europe, in a city he pointedly calls a whited sepulcher. And just to translate that Victorian phrasing for a moment, a whited sepulcher is a tomb that has been painted white on the outside to look beautiful and pristine, but inside, it is full of decaying bones.
It's a perfect metaphor for the civilization he's leaving behind. So he gets appointed skipper of a river steamboat through the influence of his aunt. And the way the vacancy opened up is deeply telling.
Oh, this is so grim. The previous captain, a man named Friesleven, was killed in a scuffle with a native.
Over two black hands.
Marlowe tells us Friesleven was the gentlest, quietest creature that ever walked on two legs. But after a couple of years out there, he felt the need to assert his self-respect. So he went ashore and started mercilessly beating the village chief with a stick.
And the chief's son stabbed him in desperation. The village fled in mad terror, and the grass grew tall enough to hide Friesleven's ribs.
Why do you think a man described as incredibly gentle snaps over poultry? I mean, such an absurd, bleak, inciting incident.
Because the jungle has a way of mathematically crushing a human sense of self-importance. Friesleven was stripped of his European context, stripped of the societal mirror that told him he was important. The dispute over the hens became an existential battle for his own relevance and authority.
He had to prove he existed.
Yeah, he had to enforce the idea of his dominance, and it ended in a pathetic, completely avoidable death. It perfectly captures the petty cruelty of the colonial enterprise.
So with this ominous precedent, Marlowe visits the company offices in the sepulchral city to sign his contract. And the imagery here is instantly mythic. He encounters two women sitting on straw-bottomed chairs knitting black wool.
The younger woman introduces people, while the older one sits with a cat on her lap, scrutinizing the cheery and foolish faces of the young men going out to the colonies with a swift, indifferent placidity.
Marlowe notes that she seemed uncanny and fateful.
Yeah.
He thinks of them guarding the door of darkness, knitting black wool as for a warm pall. They represent the mythological fates, spinning and measuring the thread of human life.
He even silently greets the older one with the gladiator salute. Ave morituri te salutant. Those who are about to die salute you.
It's incredibly eerie. He knows on some level he is crossing a threshold. And right after that, he visits an old company doctor who insists on measuring his skull with calipers.
Yes. The doctor asks if there's any madness in his family and cheerfully notes that the real changes take place inside.
I mean, this is phrenology, right? The debunked Victorian pseudoscience of predicting personality from skull shape.
Yeah, and the irony is thick. The doctor is trying to quantify and measure the human soul using the tools of civilized science, completely oblivious to the fact that the actual psychological devastation Marlowe will face cannot be mapped with calipers.
The doctor is safely insulated in the white tomb of the city, sending men into the psychological meat grinder.
After saying goodbye to his aunt, who, by the way, talks a lot of humbug about weaning ignorant millions from their horrid ways, completely missing the point that the company is run purely for profit, the voyage finally begins.
He travels on a French steamer down the coast of Africa, and the way Conrad describes this coast is just haunting. It's almost featureless, a colossal jungle, dark green to the point of being almost black, fringed with white surf.
The ship just casually drops soldiers and custom house clerks into this godforsaken wilderness.
Marlowe says watching the coast slip by is like thinking about an enigma. It seems to keep him away from the truth of things, trapped within the toil of a mournful and senseless delusion.
And that sense of senseless delusion reaches a peak when they encounter a French man of war anchored off the coast, an entire warship sitting off a formless, empty coast, firing its 6-inch guns into a blank continent.
Pop goes the gun. A small flame, a little white smoke, a feeble screech, and nothing happens.
I'm so glad you brought this up early, because this fundamentally shifts how you read the book. When you hear Heart of Darkness, you expect pure, unadulterated tragedy. But Conrad spends so much time detailing this sheer, bureaucratic, absurd comedy.
Marlowe explicitly notes there is a touch of insanity in the proceeding, a sense of lugubrious drollery. Which is such a brilliant phrase.
It translates roughly to a toxic tragic comedy.
Yeah. It is so depressing, so completely unmoored from reason, that it loops right back around to being darkly hilarious, like laughing at a funeral because the absurdity is just too much.
The mechanics of it highlight the insanity. Firing a 6-inch artillery shell into an immense jungle, the concussive sound, the expense of the shell, the massive coordination required by the naval crew all to shoot at absolutely nothing, while the men on the ship are dying of fever at the rate of 3 a day.
It's an empty performance of power. And this underlying absurdity sets the stage for Marlowe's arrival at the outer station, where the descent into chaos truly accelerates.
He takes a smaller steamer to his company's outer station, and the first thing he sees is just inhabited devastation. A boiler wallowing in the grass, an undersized railway truck lying on its back with its wheels in the air, pieces of decaying machinery.
And there's objectless blasting going on. A cliff is being blown up for no apparent reason. It's not clearing a path. It's just destroying rock to look busy.
The illusion of industry without any of the actual labor. And amidst this rusted machinery, Marlowe sees the chain gang. 6 black men toiling up the path, ribs showing, balancing baskets of earth on their heads connected by an iron collar and a chain.
They're called criminals, but Marlowe recognizes them instantly as unhappy savages, ground down by this insoluble mystery from the sea. The laws of Europe have been violently applied to people who have no concept of them.
He walks away to avoid the sight of them, steps into the shade of some trees, and realizes he's stepped into the gloomy circle of an inferno. This is the Grove of Death.
It is one of the most harrowing, viscerally upsetting scenes in the entire book.
It is the absolute collapse of the colonial idea. Marlowe finds moribund shapes, black shadows of disease and starvation. These were men brought from the coast under legal contracts, forced to work, fed unfamiliar food, who have sickened and crawled away to die in the shade.
It is an industrial slaughterhouse running entirely on neglect. He offers a ship's biscuit to a young man whose eyes are enormous and vacant, and he notices the man has a bit of white worsted, like a white string tied around his neck.
Why? Was it a badge? An ornament? A charm?
It's this jarring, pitiful symbol of European influence wrapped around a dying man's throat. And the sheer cognitive dissonance of what happens next is what makes this book so structurally brilliant.
Because right after seeing this unimaginable suffering, this literal pile of dying human beings, Marlowe walks toward the station buildings and encounters a white man who is impeccably dressed.
High starched collar, white cuffs, light alpaca jacket, snowy trousers, varnished boots. It is the company's chief accountant.
He looks like a hairdresser's dummy. And Marlowe initially respects him for keeping up appearances. He thinks the starched collars are a sign of character, a backbone.
But is it character? I genuinely struggle with this. Is maintaining a starched collar in a jungle a sign of discipline? Or is it psychopathy? 50 feet away, people are dying of starvation in the dirt, and this man is worried about clerical errors.
He actually complains that the groans of a sick agent in his hut are distracting his attention and making it hard to keep his ledger perfectly balanced.
He has completely partitioned his mind. He has shut out the horror so effectively that human suffering is nothing more than an annoyance to his accounting.
It is psychopathy wrapped in the guise of administrative efficiency. And it's here, in the office of this perfectly dressed psychopath, that Marlowe first hears the name of Mr. Kurtz.
The accountant tells him Kurtz is a first-class agent, a very remarkable person in charge of a trading post in the true ivory country, who sends in as much ivory as all the others put together.
Kurtz is immediately established as a prodigy, the ultimate success story of this horrific system.
So Marlowe waits there for 10 days, then embarks on a brutal 200-mile trek inland with a caravan of 60 men to reach the central station where his steamboat is supposed to be waiting.
It is a grueling march through empty land and abandoned villages. The native populations have completely fled from the European presence.
When he finally hobbles into the central station, he receives devastating news. His steamboat is at the bottom of the river.
And it is a completely unnatural wreck. The manager of the central station had taken it out in a sudden hurry with a volunteer skipper and tore the bottom out of her on stones within 3 hours.
Was it intentional? Because Marlowe suspects it was intentional, or at least born of such extreme incompetence that it blurs the line.
It serves the manager's purpose perfectly. The manager is a fascinating study in a very specific kind of evil. He inspires neither love nor fear, only uneasiness. He has no genius for organizing, no learning, no intelligence.
His only real power is his triumphant health. He simply outlasts everyone else. Sickness doesn't touch him.
By sinking the boat, he delays Marlowe from reaching Kurtz, whom the manager views as a massive threat to his own position.
This central station is a nightmare of a different kind. It is run by this manager, and it's full of white men strolling aimlessly about with long staves, whom Marlowe sardonically dubs the Pilgrims.
And we have to talk about the absurdity of these pilgrims. Conrad calls the devil driving these men a flabby, pretending, weak-eyed devil of a rapacious and pitiless folly.
They are bewitched by greed, but utterly lack the hardihood or courage to actually achieve anything. The word ivory rings in the air. They seem to pray to it, yet they do no actual work.
They beguile the time by backbiting and intriguing against each other for percentages and promotions. It's a devastating indictment of systems that prioritize appearances and internal politics over reality.
I always compare the central station to the worst, most toxic corporate office imaginable. It's a place where everyone is trying to get promoted, everyone is CCing the boss on passive-aggressive emails, but literally no one knows how to do their jobs.
The drainage pipes are smashed, machinery is rusting, but the PR buzzwords are still flowing. Take the brickmaker, for example.
Oh, the brickmaker. He's an agent who makes absolutely zero bricks. He's been there a year and hasn't made a single brick. He claims he lacks materials. Instead, he acts as the manager's spy.
And inside the brickmaker's room, Marlowe sees a painting, a sketch in oils of a woman draped and blindfolded, carrying a lighted torch. The background is somber, almost black. It was painted by Mr. Kurtz.
That painting is practically a thesis statement for the colonial mission's dangerous delusion. The blindfolded bringer of light into the darkness, she is bringing civilization, but she cannot see the destruction she is causing.
She is blind to her own reality. The brickmaker calls Kurtz an emissary of pity and science and progress. He tells Marlowe that the same people who sent Kurtz the Gang of Virtue also recommended Marlowe.
Marlowe realizes the manager and the brickmaker are deeply threatened by Curse's ideology and his success. Marlowe decides to play along, letting the brickmaker believe he has immense influence in Europe simply because he thinks it might help Kurtz in some vague way.
But what really drives me crazy in this section, and it highlights the absurdity we were talking about earlier, is Marlowe's obsession with rivets.
The rivets are essential.
Right. He just wants to fix his sunken boat. He has plates that would patch the hull, but he has nothing to fasten them with.
He knows there are cases of rivets piled up and bursting open down at the coast. You could literally kick loose rivets in the dirt in the station yard down by the ocean. But up at the central station where they are desperately needed, there isn't a single one.
It is a massive supply chain failure that reflects the moral and structural failure of the entire enterprise.
I mean, he practically begs the brickmaker for them. He and the boilermaker do a jig on the deck because they think rivets are finally coming. But they don't come. Why can't they just send a messenger to get the rivets?
Because the system is not designed to be productive, it is designed to extract. The rivets represent the practical glue holding reality and sanity together against this fantastic invasion.
Without rivets, there is no work. Without work, there is only the creeping madness of the station, the backbiting, the aimless wandering.
The failure of the company to provide rivets is the ultimate symbol of their systemic failure to provide anything of structural, moral, or practical value.
And what arises instead of rivets? The El Dorado Exploring Expedition. This devoted band arrives in sections, led by donkeys, carrying tents and camp stools and white cases.
Marlowe says they look like they are lugging the loot of outfit shops into the wilderness. They have the talk of sordid buccaneers, greedy without audacity, cruel without courage.
They wander into the jungle to tear treasure out of the earth with no more moral purpose than burglars breaking into a safe.
And nature responds appropriately. Long afterwards, news comes that all the donkeys are dead. As for the men, Marlowe dryly notes, they no doubt found what they deserved. The gentle swallowed them whole.
So, after months of agonizing delays, Marlowe finally manages to patch the boat without the proper rivets, and the journey upriver begins. This is where the psychological pressure cooker really seals shut.
Marlowe, the manager, a few pilgrims, and a crew of natives. Navigating this river is described as traveling back to the earliest beginnings of the world.
The air is thick, heavy, sluggish. There is a great silence that doesn't resemble peace. It's the stillness of an implacable force brooding over an inscrutable intention.
The psychological toll of the navigation is immense. The river is treacherous. Marlowe has to focus intensely on the surface of the water snags, hidden banks, sunken stones, just to keep the tin pot steamboat from sinking.
He points out that attending to the mere incidents of the surface hides the inner truth. It is a coping mechanism. The reality of the wilderness is too overwhelming to contemplate directly, so he focuses on the mechanics of steering.
But how do you stay sane when the mechanics aren't enough?
Right.
About 50 miles below the inner station, they find an abandoned reed hut with a warning. Wood for you. Hurry up. Approach cautiously.
And inside the hut, Marlowe finds a book, an inquiry into some points of seamanship by Tosin. It's an old, dreary manual full of illustrative diagrams and repulsive tables of figures about the breaking strain of ship's chains and tackle.
To a modern reader, a manual on chains sounds incredibly boring. But to Marlowe, finding it is like coming upon something unmistakably real.
In the midst of the fantastic invasion where words have lost their meaning and work is merely a pretense, Tosin's book represents an honest concern for the right way of going to work.
It's the math. The math holds the universe together when everything else is falling apart. The dreary mathematics of chains and tackle prove that logic and cause and effect still exist somewhere.
It is an anchor against the bewildering dream sensation of the jungle and the margin notes in the book. Marlowe thinks they are written in cipher, an extravagant mystery.
It turns out they are just written in Russian by a previous visitor, but for a while that cipher represents the impenetrability of human intention in this environment.
Which perfectly sets the stage for the literal impenetrability they face next. About 8 miles from Kurtz's station, they drop anchor for the night. The next morning, a white fog settles over them, blinding, clammy, and complete.
And from the fog comes a very loud cry of infinite desolation, followed by a complaining clamor of savage discords. The sheer unexpectedness of it is terrifying. They are totally blind in the mist, surrounded by an unseen presence.
The auditory isolation of this moment is brilliant. When the fog finally lifts, they move forward through a narrow channel close to the bank. Suddenly, Arrows are flying thick around the pilot house. The pilgrims, terrified, start firing their rifles blindly into the bush.
The helmsman, a native educated by the previous captain to steer the boat, drops the wheel, grabs a rifle, and fires out the shutter. He abandons his discipline.
And in doing so, he gets hit the side by a spear. Marlowe has to take the wheel, pull the steam whistle to scare off the attackers, and watch the helmsman die at his feet. His shoes literally fill with the man's blood.
And amidst all this chaos, Marlowe's dominant thought is a sense of extreme disappointment. He thinks Kurtz must be dead, and he realizes that the entire time he had been looking forward to one thing, just hearing Kurtz talk.
That is a crucial realization. He says the man presented himself as a voice. It wasn't about shaking his hand, it was about hearing him. Marlowe's entire journey has become a quest to find a voice that makes sense of the darkness.
But of course, Kurtz isn't dead. They arrive at the inner station and are greeted by this completely surreal figure, a Russian sailor dressed in clothes covered in bright patches of blue, red, and yellow.
The Harlequin. He's the one who left the book. And the Harlequin is completely devoted to Kurtz. He explains that the natives attacked the boat because they didn't want Kurtz to be taken away.
He says Kurtz has enlarged his mind, that they talked all night of everything, even of love.
But the reality of Kurtz's dominion immediately contradicts the Harlequin's romanticized devotion. As Marlowe looks through his binoculars at Kurtz's ruined house, he notices that the decorative knobs on the fence posts aren't carved wood.
Oh, this is the moment. This is where the ice breaks entirely. Marlowe focuses his binoculars and realizes they are human heads.
Black, dried, sunken, with closed eyelids, smiling continuously at some endless dream. And the Harlequin tries to justify it, saying they are the heads of rebels. But Marlowe sees right through it.
Crucially, and this is a detail that changes everything about how we understand Kurtz's psychology, the faces of the heads are turned inward. They are facing Kurtz's house.
Wait, hold on. The heads are facing inward, toward his own house. That makes zero tactical sense. If I am setting up a perimeter of severed heads, the goal is to scare away my enemies. You face the spikes outward, toward the jungle, to say, keep out. Why on earth would he want dead eyes staring at him while he drinks his morning coffee?
Because it is not about tactics. It is not about warning others. It is about reflection. The inward-facing heads are monuments to his own lack of restraint.
They are the wilderness whispering to him about his own absolute godlike power.
Kurtz doesn't need to warn the surrounding tribes. He has already subjugated them. He needs to continuously feed his own monstrous ego. The inward-facing heads signify a man who has become the sole audience for his own atrocities. His reality has collapsed entirely inward into an echo chamber of supreme narcissism.
That is deeply unsettling.
Yeah.
It's like imagine a deep sea creature, right? It lives at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. It is perfectly adapted to thousands of pounds of pressure per square inch. That pressure is European society, the laws, the police, the judgment of your neighbors, the butcher down the street.
But you drag that creature up to the surface, into the open air where there is absolutely no pressure. It doesn't just survive, it structurally disintegrates, it explodes outward.
Kurtz lost the societal pressure and his morality just ruptured.
That is a phenomenal way to understand it. The pilgrims at the central station are protected by their own dullness, their lack of imagination. They never reach the surface because they're weighed down by petty bureaucratic concerns.
Kurtz had imagination. He had soaring intellect and grand ideas. But when the external guardrails were removed, he found nothing inside himself to replace them. He found the hollowness.
And then Kurtz finally appears. He is brought out on a stretcher by the natives, a lank, skeletal figure, looking like an animated image of death carved out of old ivory. He opens his mouth wide as if to swallow the earth.
Even weakened and dying, his voice is deep, profound, and vibrating. The natives revere him as a deity, and among them is a figure that completely dominates the landscape.
A magnificent, gorgeous African woman, draped in striped and fringed cloths, loaded with brass and glass beads, and the value of several elephant tusks.
She walks with measured steps, proud and stately, and stretches her bare arms over the somber river.
She is the physical embodiment of the dark, passionate, and tragic soul of the wilderness itself. She represents the terrifying, vital reality of the jungle that Kurtz surrendered to. She's formidable, fierce, and completely unapologetic in her grief and her power.
Contrast her with the Intended, whom we meet at the very end of the book back in Europe. The Intended is Kurtz's fiance. She is all in black, floating in the dusk of a lofty drawing room that feels like a mausoleum.
She has a pale visage, a pure brow, surrounded by an ashy halo. Her glance is guileless and trustful. She is the exact opposite of the vital, powerful woman on the shore.
The Intended represents the European illusion. She is the beautiful, fragile lie that society tells itself to maintain the pretense of civilization. She believes Kurtz was a saint, an apostle of goodness.
Marlowe realizes that the reality of the African woman and the reality of Kurtz's actions could never be reconciled with the sterile, naive world of the intended. The two women represent the split in Kurtz's soul, and the split in the world Conrad is describing, the brutal, vital truth of exploitation on one side and the pale, mourning ignorance of the society that profits from it on the other.
The manager decides to remove Kurtz, declaring his methods unsound, which is such a hilarious understatement. Kurtz is brought aboard the steamboat, furious, claiming he's being interrupted, that he will return to carry out his great plans.
As they steam back down the river, bearing Kurtz away, his life ebbs quickly. He gives Marlowe a packet of papers and a photograph to protect his legacy. And then one evening, lying in the dark cabin, Kurtz experiences a moment of supreme knowledge.
Marlowe witnesses a change over Kurtz's features, an expression of somber pride, ruthless power, craven terror, and intense, hopeless despair. Kurtz cries out in a whisper at some vision, "The horror, the horror."
It is his final judgment upon his own soul, his ultimate realization of the darkness he has embraced and the darkness of the universe itself.
The manager's boy pops his head in and casually announces, "Mr. Kurtz, he dead." They bury him in a muddy hole. Marlowe nearly dies himself on the journey back, but he survives and returns to Europe, to the sepulchral city.
And this brings us to the final, most debated action in the book. Marlowe visits the intended. She is still in deep mourning. She asks Marlowe for Kurtz's last words, needing something to live with.
And Marlowe, who earlier states that he hates and detests a lie because it has a taint of death, looks into her trusting eyes and explicitly chooses to lie. He tells her that the last word Kurtz pronounced was her name.
She cries out in triumph and pain, believing it completely. Marlowe feels as though the heavens should fall for this lie, but they don't. He leaves her to her beautiful illusion because the truth, the horror would have been too dark altogether.
I genuinely struggle with this. Why does he lie? Does Marlowe fail his own moral test here? By preserving her illusion, he ensures that the truth what happened in the heart of darkness remains hidden.
Is the book arguing that civilization actually requires this willful ignorance? If everyone in London knew the brutal reality of how their comfort and wealth was obtained, would the whole sepulchral city collapse?
Do we build our comfortable lives actively choosing to ignore the realities that sustain them? By lying, Marlowe becomes complicit in the very system of hypocrisy he has spent the entire narrative despising.
It is a profound moral compromise. He seals the darkness away behind a mahogany door to protect the beautiful world of societal illusion. And all of these thematic weights, the hollow rhetoric, the deep-sea pressure of society, the required lies, are magnified intensely by how the story is delivered.
Which brings us to why the audiobook experience is not just an alternative way to consume Heart of Darkness, but arguably the optimal way.
When you look at the structure of the book, Heart of Darkness is explicitly, mechanically, a story about the act of listening. Marlowe isn't writing a memoir. He is a voice speaking in the dark to a captive audience on a boat.
Yes. From the perspective of the frame narrator on the Nelly, it becomes too dark to see anyone. He says, "It had become so pitch dark that we listeners could hardly see one another. For a long time already, he, sitting apart, had been no more to us than a voice."
His story shapes itself without human lips in the heavy night air of the river.
And Kurtz himself is primarily defined as a voice. Marlowe says, "I made this strange discovery that I had never imagined him as doing, you know, but as discoursing. The man presented himself as a voice."
Even at the very end, when Kurtz is a skeletal shadow of a man, Marlowe says, "A voice. A voice. It rang deep to the very last. It survived his strength to hide in the magnificent folds of eloquence the barren darkness of his heart."
Conrad is deeply concerned with the power and the danger of eloquence, of spoken words. When you read the words on a physical page, your eyes are doing the work. You control the pacing. You can look away, put the book down, distance yourself from the horror.
You are safe in a well-lit room. Your brain can parse the dense Victorian sentences at its own leisure.
But when you listen to the Clara Horatio audiobook, the dynamic shifts completely. You are put directly in the shoes of the unnamed narrator on the Nelly. You are sitting in the dark, captive to Marlowe's hypnotic, rambling, and sometimes contradictory voice.
You can't speed it up or skip the dense paragraphs without breaking the spell. You are forced to endure the journey at the pace of the river current.
The auditory experience mirrors the sensory deprivation of the fog scene. When Marlowe describes the white fog coming down like a shutter and the sudden, intolerably excessive shrieking bursting out of the mist, hearing an actor deliver that tension traps you in the sensory experience of the river.
The whispers, the throb of the drums, the final breathless whisper of the horror, the horror. These are inherently auditory phenomena. Conrad wrote a story meant to vibrate in the ear.
I liken the audiobook experience to the primal act of sitting around a campfire listening to a ghost story. The fire is warm, but the shadows at the edge of the firelight seem to move. The darkness outside the circle feels oppressive.
Marlowe's voice is the firelight, and the story he's telling forces you to look into the shadows which represent the unspoken, terrifying truths of the human condition.
And Marlowe acknowledges the difficulty of this oral transmission. He interrupts himself at one point and cries out, "Do you see the story? Do you see anything? It seems to me I'm trying to tell you a dream making a vain attempt. No, it is impossible. It is impossible to convey the life sensation of any given epoch of one's existence. We live as we dream alone."
The audiobook captures that desperate, struggling attempt of one human voice trying to bridge the gap of existential loneliness.
That ghost story around the campfire carries a warning that echoes far beyond the era of 19th century trade companies, which leads us to the modern resonance of the book. What does Heart of Darkness say about the human condition now, today, without reducing it to a high school English class cliche?
The core thematic tension that resonates most powerfully today is the concept of restraint versus hollowness. Throughout the journey, Marlowe observes different forms of restraint.
He looks at his crew of native cannibals, who have been paid in useless pieces of brass wire and has subsisted on a few lumps of rotting hippo meat. They are 30 big, powerful, starving men facing 5 plump white men. By all laws of physical necessity, they should have overwhelmed the pilgrims and eaten them.
Marlowe is absolutely baffled by it. He says, restraint. What possible restraint? Was it superstition, disgust, patience, fear, or some kind of primitive honor?
He notes that no fear can stand up to hunger. No patience can wear it out. It takes a man all his inborn strength to fight hunger properly. And yet the cannibals don't attack. They possess an innate, baffling restraint.
Contrast that with the manager. The manager also possesses restraint, but it is of a remarkably shallow kind. When they are stuck in the fog and hear the screams, the manager says he would be desolated if anything happened to Mr. Kurtz.
Marlowe notes that the manager is sincere, but only because he is just the kind of man who would wish to preserve appearances. That was his restraint.
His morality is entirely dictated by the rules of corporate decorum and self-preservation. It is a suit he wears, not a conviction he holds.
And then we get to Kurtz. Kurtz has no restraint, not at all. And the reason he has no restraint is because, as Marlowe discovers, he is hollow at the core.
When the wilderness tested him, when the guardrails of Europe were removed, there was nothing inside to stop his monstrous passions.
We see the terrifying danger of this hollowness in Kurtz's report for the International Society for the Suppression of Savage Customs. Marlowe reads it. It is 17 pages of eloquent, vibrating, magnificent peroration.
Kurtz argues that whites appear as supernatural beings, that by the simple exercise of will, they can exert a practically unbounded power for good. It is a soaring altruistic appeal that makes Marlowe tingle with enthusiasm.
But then comes the postscript. Scrawled much later, in an unsteady hand, at the very end of this beautiful moralistic essay, it blazes like a flash of lightning. Exterminate all the brutes.
That is the modern resonance right there. The profound danger of soaring, altruistic rhetoric masking catastrophic harm. Kurtz was considered a universal genius.
We are told he was an artist, a journalist, a musician. A cousin tells Marlowe that Kurtz could electrify large meetings, that he had the faith and could get himself to believe anything, that he would have been a splendid leader of an extreme political party.
It doesn't matter which party or which century. He represents the intoxicating, destructive danger of pure charisma divorced from moral grounding.
How often today do we see leaders, innovators, or visionaries who speak beautifully about changing the world, about progress and humanizing our future? But when you look at the actual mechanics of their empires, you find the equivalent of objectless blasting, smashed drainage pipes, and a grove of death.
The capacity for brilliant people to justify horrific actions through the sheer force of their own eloquence is a timeless human flaw.
It forces you to question the systems we participate in today. Are we the pilgrims, wandering aimlessly, obsessed with our own petty percentages, blind to the suffering our supply chains create?
Are we relying on the beautiful rhetoric of progress to excuse systemic destruction?
And that is the emotional weight of the journey. The darkness Conrad describes is not a geographic location on a map. It is an ever-present latency within the human mind, waiting patiently for the external checks and balances to fall away.
Which leaves us with our final thought. At the very end of the story, Marlowe ceases speaking. The listeners on the Nelly look out at the tranquil waterway of the Thames under an overcast sky.
And the narrator realizes that this river, leading to the uttermost ends of the earth, seems to lead into the heart of an immense darkness. The darkness isn't out there, it's right here. It's in London, it's in us.
So, as you prepare to embark on this audio journey, I challenge you to ask yourself, if all your external guardrails, your reputation, your fear of the law, the gaze of your neighbors, the structures of your daily routine were removed today, what kind of shape would your inner truth take?
Would you find solid ground? A deliberate belief? Tosin's manual of honest work? Or would you find that the wilderness echoes loudly inside you because you too are hollow at the core?
It is a question that requires courage to answer. To confront this journey directly, to feel the fog and hear the whispers, we strongly encourage you to listen to the full Clara Naroscio audiobook of Heart of Darkness.
Let Marlowe's voice pull you into the shadows. We promise it is an experience that will stay with you long after the final word is spoken. Until next time, keep listening and keep questioning.